of Lincolnshire and Norfolk towards the afternoon, and maybe swinging towards the southeast of England as we head towards the evening. But detail of those showers, I'm afraid, is open to a bit of uncertainty. For Wales, the West Midlands and Northern England, the weather cheering up, but there could be some heavy downpours for Northern England, particularly the Pennines, over towards perhaps Yorkshire, and maybe across the northeast of Wales as well. Potentially some thunderstorms here. Northern Ireland, after a cloudy start, brightens up. Sunny spells, highs of 21 degrees Celsius. And in Scotland, a cloudy start to the day with a few spots of rain in the north and east, where it will probably stay cloudy in the afternoon. The best of the sunshine in the west, with temperatures of around 21 degrees. That's the latest weather. Jim.
Must be a bank holiday on the way. Thank you, Chris. Now, Nigel Anthony continues his reading of Operation Massacre. One summer evening in 1956, the owner of an apartment house in a suburb of Buenos Aires is listening to a boxing match on the radio with one of his neighbours when they're astonished to be raided by the police.
Mr. Horacio and his guest, Yunta, don't even have time to object as they're taken out and bundled into a police precinct, Plymouth. A red bus and a light blue police van are parked alongside. In the meantime, it seems that a man has escaped across the patio. Torres, the occupant of the back apartment, was on his way to the front, where he sometimes used the phone. Lisasso was with him. They heard the police, and Lisasso also tried to escape, but failed. Meanwhile, in the back apartment, the police encounter no opposition. Nobody moves a finger. The assembled men are ordered onto the street one by one, where the leader of the police punches and kicks them as they're loaded onto the bus.
So you were going to start a revolution, huh?
As he asks everyone their names, it's clear they mean nothing to him. But when he hears Gavino's name, his face lights up with joy.
So you're Gavino. Tell me where you've hidden him. Where's Tonko? Now, right away, because I'll kill you right here. It's no skin off my back.
Gavino's eyes are glazed over with fear, but he doesn't reply. Either he's a hero, or he hasn't the slightest idea where the rebel general is. Yunta and Mr. Horacio are ordered out of the Plymouth and onto the bus, and at the last minute three more men who've been arrested nearby get on as well. One's a night watchman at the nearby piping plant. Another's a driver who happened to be passing. And the third is a young man who was saying goodnight to his girlfriend. The bus sets out with its usual driver, who'd been detained for the purpose 45 minutes earlier. The prisoners don't know where they're going or why, except maybe one or two of them. But one manages to hear the nickname of the leader of the operation. It's the chief of the police department of the province of Buenos Aires, retired Lieutenant Colonel Fernandez Suarez. Mr. Horacio's wife and daughter believe they're living in a nightmare. Their house is invaded by policemen who interrogate them and shout to each other at the top of their lungs. Mr. Horacio's daughter tries to step away from the door where the chief of police is looking for revolutionary schemes among her undergarments. Far away from the house, the real uprising is raging furiously. The proclamation, signed by Generals Vage and Tonko, explains the root of the rebellion, claiming that the country is living under a harsh and merciless tyranny. People are being persecuted, imprisoned, and exiled. The majority party is being excluded from public life, with people living under the totalitarian monstrosity of a decree which prohibits even mentioning Perón. Their proclamation proposes a considered return to Peronism by transparent means, with election within no more than 180 days. The story of the uprising is short. Less than 12 hours pass between the time that the operations begin and defeat of the last rebel group. In Campo de Mayo, the rebels take control of both the NCO Academy Infantry Group and the service group of the 1st Armoured Division, but the occupation of the NCO Academy fails after a short shootout. There are two or three skirmishes near the military region command in Avellaneda. The police arrest some of the rebels, then burst into the industrial school where a group is trying to set up a command with a radio receiver for Vage. The repression is devastating. 18 civilians and 2 military officers are sent to a summary court-martial, and 6 are later executed. In La Plata, a bomb thrown at a shoe store appears to be the sign the rebels are waiting for. Groups of civilians take over the telephone exchanges. Astounded passers-by see a number of Sherman tanks go by, followed by troops in armoured trucks, heading at full speed for the 2nd Division Command and the police station. The police chief isn't there. He's too busy inspecting Mr. Horacio's furniture in Florida. 99 out of every 100 people in the country are unaware of what's going on. At 11:56, state radio puts on the marching song that's used to end their programming as the voice of the announcer bids his listeners good night. Not a word has been uttered about the subversive events of the night. Not even the slightest allusion has been made to martial law, which, like any law, must be publicly declared before coming into effect. But it is already being applied, and will be applied later to men who were arrested before it was instated, and without the excuse, like the one they had in Avellaneda, that they'd been caught with weapons in hand. Meanwhile, the bus full of prisoners picked up in Florida has headed southwest. Some of the prisoners talk to each other.
Why do you think they've taken us?
What do I know? Probably for playing cards.
Something doesn't smell right. The big guy said something about a revolution.
Mr. Horacio and Yunta are the most baffled of all, because they weren't even playing cards. Gavino, who doesn't know them, but could enlighten them, keeps quiet. Dazed and dishevelled, wiping blood from his lip, he does know why they've been taken. At 12:11 a.m, state radio surprisingly resumes its broadcast, playing a selection of light music. It's the first official sign that something serious is happening. At the fateful house in Florida, two more victims are claimed. Troxler and Benavides stop by looking for a friend. They do nothing more than walk down the alleyway and ring the bell when the door opens and a sergeant and two guards appear pointing their guns at them. Troxler, though surprised, hardly bats an eyelid. He's a Peronist, and though he doesn't talk much politics, one thing's for sure. He's familiar with the police and knows how to deal with them. By an extraordinary coincidence, Troxler knows the sergeant who's pointing his gun at him.
What's happened?
I don't know. I have to take you both with me.
What do you mean? Don't you remember me?
Yes, sir, but I have my orders.
The two detained men are left alone with the guards. They could try to overpower them, but they're calm. Clearly they don't suspect anything too serious. And then they let themselves be taken away. Just like that. At precisely 12:32, state radio interrupts the chamber music to announce martial law. The radio is on in the office of Chief Inspector Moreno, chief of the San Martin District Police Department. The declaration of martial law has been replayed several times since 12:32, and now at 1:45 a.m. they are broadcasting it again. One of the prisoners has asked permission to go to the bathroom. The guard escorting him lets him in on what's happening. When he returns, there's anxiety amongst the others as he confirms the fears that have been accumulating since they heard the police chief utter the word revolution for the first time at 11 o'clock the previous night. Gavino, however, lets out a sigh of relief. He knows they can't do anything to him. He was arrested before martial law was instated, so he can't have violated it. A change has come over the building. It's hardly noticeable, but sinister. The guard's attitude, which until now has been carefree, has turned sour and surly. Chief Inspector Moreno has a bad feeling. Why did these poor bastards have to be sent to him, of all people?
We're going to take your statements, he says.
The prisoners line up in two groups, one to go to the chief's office, the other to his second in command, Captain Cuejo. Liveraga is unsettled. He doesn't want to believe that his friend Rodriguez has screwed him over, but an awful suspicion keeps rolling around in his head.
On the bus, he'd asked him,
"Big guy, are you involved in anything?"
His friend has shrugged his shoulders. Now he makes sure to follow his friend in to the same interrogator. The session is long and thorough. Livaraga stresses that he only went to the house to hear the fight on the radio. Gavino knows perfectly well that they're not going to believe him if he says he was also at Torres's apartment by accident. He and Carranza both admit that they're Peronist sympathizers, who expected there'd be an uprising and went to hear the news on the radio. Mr. Horacio is asked,
"What were you doing in that house?"
"What would I be doing? It's my house."
"What were you doing?"
"Listening to the radio." Troxler and Benavides have been kept in a different office, and their testimonies are shorter. After all, they did nothing more than arrive at the apartment when it was all over and ring a doorbell. By 3:45 a.m., the interrogations have ended. Two officers stand near the door.
"If this thing turns around, we can let these guys go."
But the thing doesn't turn around. At 4:45 a.m., it seems as though Chief Inspector Moreno is trying to buy time. He probably doesn't think killing 10 or 15 unlucky saps is a very pleasant way to spend his evening. He's personally convinced that more than half of them have nothing to do with anything. He even has doubts about the rest. He has a tense exchange with the chief of police. The orders are strict. Execute them. The alternative? Be subject to martial law himself. At the last minute, three of them get lucky. The night watchman, the man who went to have dinner, and the man who was saying goodnight to his girlfriend, all picked up off the street in the vicinity of the house, are pulled aside, given back their identity papers, and set free. Moreno will later say that he released them of his own accord. The rest are taken outside. A blue truck is parked in front of the department. It's open on both sides and has wooden seats that cut across the middle. Next to it, Captain Cuejo is nervously rubbing his hands. One of the prisoners asks,
"Where are they taking us?"
"Don't worry, we're transferring you to La Plata."
The men get on, accompanied by about a dozen guards. The thing that stands out is that the policemen are armed with rifles. Given the kind of operation they're carrying out, it's nearly incomprehensible that they have rifles rather than machine guns. Is it some kind of an out that Moreno is consciously or unconsciously giving the prisoners? It's impossible to tell, but what's certain is that half of those condemned to die will make it out alive. But they don't know that they're condemned, and this outrageous cruelty ought to be highlighted. They've not been told that they're going to be killed. The guards draw the canvas curtains, and the truck heads northwest. The prisoners are travelling in nearly total darkness. It's biting cold.
"I think they're going to kill us," Brion says.
Yunta tries to console him.
"Don't think about those things, Mr. Mario. Didn't you hear them say they're taking us to La Plata?"
If they could see anything, they'd realise that they are in fact getting farther and farther away from their alleged destination. Continuing west on Route 8, there's true barren land, the perfect setting for what's about to happen. And yet they turn north towards José León Suárez and enter a semi-populated area. What is Chief Inspector Moreno thinking? Is it stupidity or remorse? An unconscious impulse to seek out witnesses for the crime that he's going to commit? Does he want to give the condemned men a sporting chance? Or does he want to calm them down so that it'll be easier to kill them?
Nigel Anthony has been reading Operation Massacre by Rodolfo Walsh. The programme was abridged and produced by Jane Marshall Productions. BBC Radio 4. Now the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 today, Thursday the 22nd of August. There are warnings of gales in Rockall. The general synopsis at 1800. Atlantic low moving steadily northeast, expected 260 miles west of Rockall, 975 by 1800 Thursday. High Faroes, 1024, expected Norwegian Sea, 1025 by the same time. Low Scotland, 1016, losing its identity. The area forecast for the next 24 hours, Viking, north at zero, south at zero, east 40s. Northeasterly, veering southeasterly 4, fair, moderate or good. West 40s, Cromarty, 4th, Tyne. Variable 4, becoming southeasterly 5. Occasional rain, fog patches, moderate or poor, occasionally.